I went to Gibraltar, where I found the vessel as tight and seaworthy as when she left this port, except that a few sails that had been left set had been carried away.
The New York Herald, March 15th, 1873.
Welcome to the Oddity Archive with Evan and David.
Welcome back to the Oddity Archive, Season 2, Episode 2.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. So, David, it's been a minute. I know this is only episode 2 of season 2, but we took a little break there for me to kind of travel around a little bit. A lot of work stuff, a little vacation, but I just want to say thanks to Ian for stepping in. I had a great time stowed away in his attic. He was a great host. And thanks to you for carrying the torch while I was out. How'd it go?
It went well. I had a lot of fun recording those bonus episodes. It was just a little bit lighter, just going with the flow of things. I didn't have to research anything, so I wasn't like racking my brain day after day. Like, well, how am I going to make this story work for a podcast? It was just hit play and what happens happens.
I like to listen to them and it made my job much easier that they were chronological, but no, props, they were fun bonus episodes to fill the gap.
That was the goal, and it's been a while since we've been in the booth recording.
It is. I don't know if I could even tell you when the last time was, but it must have been at least a month ago,
because this really, to me, it feels like the start of season two. I know this will be episode two, but we had that first one recorded before season one ended.
Yeah.
And so this kind of has the feel of this is the start of season two.
Yeah.
I think I talked about this in the Satoshi Nakamoto episode, but I was planning to do tonight's episode as episode one. But once I got into the research of it, It went way longer than I was expecting. So I was like, I'm not going to be able to do this justice on like a short time span. So I put it on the back burner and got back to it after we were done rolling out season one.
Any reason this one was a heavier lift?
Because I wanted to start the season with a similar thing as season one. This episode, the story of the Mary Celeste, is kind of very similar to the Dyatlov Pass episode.
Okay.
You'll see there's a lot of history, there's a lot of buildup, and then there is one overarching question. There's going to be a why did they leave the tent moment, and that's kind of where the mystery lies for the Mary Celeste.
Okay.
But getting into that, What do you think about boats?
What do I think about boats?
Do you like going on boats?
So the vacation part of my travel was actually going to Niagara Falls, and we did the boat that kind of takes you right up on the falls. It doesn't look like they get that close from up on the hill or whatever you want to call it, but yeah. When you're on the actual boat, you're like, is this the one that finally goes under? So a little bit of that, but a very cool experience, highly recommend it. And I also, after the boat ride, proposed to our social team member Jessica, so we are now to be betrothed.
Fiancés.
We have fiancéed up.
Very cool. I was laying on the couch watching some shows two Sunday nights ago, and you just texted me spontaneously. We hadn't texted in a few days. Mm-hmm. And you were like, hey, did you get the bonus episode 2 scheduled for release? Like, I just want to make sure everything's good to go for it and everything. And I was like, yeah, I got it scheduled. Everything's good. And then, you know, I said, how's your trip going? And you're like, oh, I just got engaged like an hour ago. It's like, what is wrong with you?
I just always have this fear in the back of my head. I'm somehow going to be the bottleneck for something going sideways. I'm like, as long as I'm good there, the engagement will go fine. But what about that episode release? Gotta make sure we're good.
Yeah. You're like, will you marry me? Please answer quickly because I gotta text David about this episode.
Hey, I'll be right back. I'll be right back. Think about your answer. I'll be right back.
That's very cool. Congratulations. Yeah, yeah. Again.
Thank you so much.
I do have one Niagara Falls story now that you brought it up.
Yeah. Yeah. What you got?
So, like, in any of those stupid meetings where you meet new people and it's like, say a fun fact about yourself.
Oh, like icebreaker stuff?
Yeah. One of the things I'll use is that in my life, I have only ever been outside of the United States for literally 10 minutes.
Even to this day.
Even to this day. To this okay. day. I have family that live up in Buffalo, New York. So I've been to Niagara Falls a few times. And one time when I was younger, and you didn't need a passport or like a special license or anything.
Yeah, I think you used to be able to just kind of freely cross if you were a U.S. citizen.
You could just cross. Yeah. You had to go through customs and stuff, but like you didn't need anything fancy.
It was way breezier.
Yeah. And so one of the times that we went when we were younger, my parents were like, hey, do y'all want to see it from the Canadian side? We've never done that before. And I was like, well, sure, let's go to Canada. So we went across the Peace Bridge, mm-hmm. went through customs, went out, looked at Niagara Falls from the Canadian side for about 10 minutes, and then came back across the Peace Bridge to the United States.
It is a cool bridge, though. For some reason, I thought it would be like too high up or too far of a gap for it. But correct me if I'm wrong, but there's like Canadian flag on one side and then American on the one side of the bridge where you kind of make that cross point from one country to the other.
Yeah, I think so. The border's technically like the middle of the bridge or something.
I'll say you may have been 8 when this happened too, so I don't, you might be like, sure.
Yeah, the memory's kind of fuzzy, but yeah, it was only about 10 minutes I was in Canada, and that's the only time I've ever left the country.
Are you on some sort of no flight list we should know about?
You know, I've gone deep on the alien research, so they might got me on some kind of list.
I'll say the odd tour may have to be just a national event, nothing international.
The odd tour might not be able to cross the Mississippi.
But we won't go into why.
I don't know if you remember from bonus episode 2, but we're going to do the odd tour just outside of Skinwalker Ranch at some point.
That's right. Yeah.
When we get all that scheduled.
So I guess to go back to your question, how do I feel about boats? That's my most recent experience. That was great, but I definitely had to take a beat once I got off because the motion sickness was a little brutal. But what brings boats to your mind?
So tonight's episode is about the Mary Celeste. This is a very famous ghost ship, or maybe cursed ship, something of that nature. There's no real ghosts involved here, but sort of any ship that has something spooky involved with it is just deemed a ghost ship. Right. So that's what we're going to talk about. The Mary Celeste.
Is it Mary like Merry Christmas, or Mary Celeste like as in a name?
As in a name. MaryCeleste. The Mary Celeste. And so I'm going to run through sort of the history of this boat kind of fast. Okay. I'm not going to do the whole history of this boat justice. I'm just going to be honest. We're going to spend most of this just in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. So hopefully you know where that is. Great.
That's right in my geography sweet spot.
Yeah, this is a dense story if you want to get into every bit of history. So I'm going to go through a lot tonight, okay. But I'm only scratching the surface on the history of this boat.
I'll try and keep my stupid jokes to a minimum while you get us up to speed.
Well, it might help the time pass, actually. So this whole adventure begins in 1860. This is when the ship is originally built by Joshua Dewis on Spencer's Island in the Bay of Fundy, Nova Scotia. He built it from locally felled timber with two masts, rigged as a brigantine, which is just a type of boat, and it was Carvel built, which means the boards were flush together rather than overlapping.
He built this whole boat on his own?
Well, he had a crew of people. Oh, okay.
I'm picturing a boat like the size of the Titanic. I'm like, I don't think that he could do that.
So let me put it into perspective, because we're not talking Titanic size, yeah. But it is a pretty big boat. The boat originally was 99.3 feet long, 25.5 feet wide, and it had a depth in the water of 11.7 feet.
And that's just how far the hull goes in the water, I assume.
Yeah. And the tonnage at that point was 198.42. I assume that's the gross weight or its ability to carry cargo.
Okay.
It was going to be used to like take goods from place to place and sell them. It was built in 1860. First time it set sail is May 18th, 1861. When it was built, it was not named the Mary Celeste. It was named the Amazon. So it set sail May 18th, 1861. That was to go to port to become registered.
Okay.
So it set sail, but not in any functional kind of way. It was just like getting to the DMV in order to get your license plates. So it got registered on June 10th, 1861. And then later that month, it started the first voyage with the timber.
Got it.
On its maiden voyage, the captain's name was Captain McClellan. And just days into the trip, he falls ill and he gets so sick that the ship has to turn around and go back to port. He ends up passing away June 19th.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just
bad
like
juju from the start.
Yeah, bad juju from the start. First voyage, the captain dies prematurely. So then it still has this cargo. The people who own the boat still need this cargo to be delivered. Mm-hmm. So they get John Nutting Parker to take over the captainship, the captainhood, the captaining.
All three sound great to me.
Yeah, whatever the verb for captain is, he takes over that role for the boat. And before he gets off the East Coast, he's off the coast of Maine. He runs into a bunch of fishing equipment. Hmm. So problem number two with this boat.
Yeah.
The rest of the trip to London goes fairly smoothly. And they unload the timber, they get their money, et cetera, et cetera. On the way back to the United States, they hit another boat so badly that they sink it in the English Channel.
Yeah.
So just the maiden voyage of this boat, already something's off.
Was there like a storm or something? That seems hard to do. Like the channel, I imagine, is the more controlled part of the water before they go out into like open seas.
Yeah, you would think that there's some sort of traffic stuff going on in the English Channel.
Yeah, maybe bad weather or fog or something. Yeah.
You know, maybe John Nutting Parker wasn't a very good captain. I don't know. Because he's hitting fishing equipment off Maine. Yeah. He's sinking another boat in the English Channel.
Track record's a little spotty to start off.
1867. It continues traveling back and forth with goods and selling them and making money, et cetera, et cetera. And then in October of 1867, during whatever journey it was on at that point, hits a very bad storm and the Amazon is drove ashore at Cape Breton Island, just north of Nova Scotia.
Okay.
So just north of where it was built.
Right.
It runs ashore and the owners decide the boat's wrecked. We're going to abandon it. They give up all rights to it.
Okay. So they just left it there.
They left it there. They said, if you want it, you can have it. And same month, October of 1867, on the 15th, Alexander McBean purchases the ship as a derelict. He basically says, hey, I'll take the boat. Let me get my crew out there. We'll fix it up or whatever. We'll make it seaworthy again. So he goes, he gets the boat, and then very quickly sells it to Richard W. Haynes, who is a New Yorker, in November of 1868. So at this point, it's kind of like a used car auction, mm-hmm. where they're just trying to buy stuff, flip it, make it a few dollars here and there.
So they just went and took the boat because it was free, basically. Tried to polish it up a little bit, maybe, if that even, and then just sell it at auction.
They may have not even fixed it up at all, but they at least got it off of the shore somewhere that somebody could potentially work on it.
Yeah, gotcha.
And so he is able to sell it to Haynes. Haynes pays $1,750 for the ship. So he got it for like a fraction of the cost, and then he basically had to restore the whole thing.
Right.
So all in, he's a little over $10,000 on this boat.
Yep.
He names himself the captain.
Nice. I got to try that at work.
Yeah. I'm the captain now.
You can leave my office. Yeah.
Right. So he names himself the captain, and this is when it gets its name, because he re-registers the Amazon as the Mary Celeste.
This is Richard Haynes, right, that's doing this?
Yeah, Richard Haynes still has this. He is the one that gives the boat the name the Mary Celeste.
Okay.
So he renames it, and then 1 year later, in October of 1869, evidently Haynes did not actually have the money for this boat, because his creditors seize the ship. Haynes loses the boat to his creditors, and the creditors end up selling it to a group of New Yorkers headed by James H. Winchester. They sell it to them in early 1872.
Okay.
And he spends $10,000 on more renovations for the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually ends up changing the dimensions of the boat with his renovations. He increases the length to 103 feet. He increases the width to 25.7 feet, the depth to 16.2 feet, and he increases the tonnage to 282.28.
That's a pretty good jump.
Yeah, pretty good jump. So he spends all that money on that. And by October 29th, of 1872, the boat is owned in 12 shares by four different people. So 6 of the shares are owned by James Winchester. 4 of the shares are owned by Benjamin Spooner Briggs, who will become the captain of today's story.
Okay.
And then the final 2 shares are owned 1 each by individual minor investors. I couldn't find their names anywhere, but April 24th, 1835.
All right.
We're jumping in John Teeter's time machine for a minute. We're going back about 40 years. Mm-hmm. This is when the dream began. This is when Benjamin Spooner Briggs is born. He is one of 5 sons of Sea Captain Nathan Briggs.
And he was one of the shareholders for the boat.
He owned 4 of the 12 shares of the boat. He's the captain of the boat.
Right.
He was one of 5 sons to Nathan Briggs. Nathan Briggs was an accomplished sailor, and one of his other brothers became a captain. So this is a very sea experienced family.
Yeah, the family business.
Benjamin was devoutly religious, and he believed in abstinence from alcohol. He was not a drinker. He did not want people drinking on his boat.
Okay. So I feel like sailors are often very like rough and tumble type.
Right. And he kind of went against the mold on that one. He was very religious. He did not drink. He did not want drinking happening on his boat. Had 2 kids. His son, Arthur Briggs, at the time of today's story, he was age 7. And his daughter, Sophia Matilda, who was born on Halloween of 1870. She actually will be on the boat.
Okay.
And from all the historical records that can be found, he was known to be a good captain. People liked working for him. He was very straightforward. So he was a respected person in sailorhood world.
So yeah, it sounds like he's got a better track record than the previous captain, to say the least, who, you know, maiden voyage is just bouncing around.
Yes. Whoa, hit some fishing gear.
Was that another boat? Oh, well. You guys hear screaming?
So Benjamin is made captain of the Mary Celeste, and he has to find his crew who's going to go on this voyage with him. He takes his wife and his daughter, Sophia, with him. Mm-hmm. His son, Arthur, stayed back because he was in a boarding school, I believe, or some type of school. And so he stayed back and was under the care of his grandmother while this voyage happened.
Sophia, I imagine, is a little younger than him then.
Yeah, she's 2 at the time.
Okay.
Which, 2-year-old on a boat for...
makes my palms sweat.
A couple months. That's going to be a rough voyage.
Yeah.
And no drinking going on the boat.
No reprieve.
So they got the 3 of them, small family going. And then as far as sailors that he had on the boat with him, mm-hmm. he had his first mate, Albert G. Richardson, who was married to a niece of Winchester. So the guy who owns most of the boat, mm-hmm. he was married to one of the owner's nieces.
The first mate was.
Yeah, the first mate was. Okay. So there's some family connection between the first mate and majority owner of the boat.
Gotcha.
Albert G. Richardson had sailed under Briggs before, so Briggs was okay with this. It wasn't like a, hey, take my niece's husband with you because I'm the owner and you do what I say kind of thing.
Speaking of first mate, wink, wink.
So Benjamin, he knew Albert. They were good. He was his first mate. The second mate, Andrew Gilling, he was in his mid-20s, born in New York. He was a Danish sailor.
Okay.
Then you have the steward, the newly married Edward William Head, and he was signed with a personal recommendation from Winchester. So again, Winchester was like, hey, I trust this guy. You should take him along. He's a good sailor.
It sounds like freelance work, basically, where it's just... somebody vouches for you, welcome aboard.
Yeah, yeah. And then they had 4 general seamen who were all Germans, brothers Volkert and Boz Lorenzen, Arian Martins, Gottlieb Gaunschall.
Mm-hmm. Flawless German, as always.
Yeah. Gottlieb Gaunschall. And they were all described as peaceable first-class sailors. So it was a pretty tight-knit group of sailors. There weren't any like rogue people out there. Yeah. Like, I don't think any of them had eye patches, pegged legs, none of that going on.
Well, and if it's like, you know, by all accounts, a sober ship, I feel like you're going to attract a certain kind of sailor in that regard.
Yeah. You're not going to get some rough and tumble.
I wouldn't be allowed on board, for example.
I don't know. You might be hiding your wine in a high.
Oh, this? Oh, no, that's for water spigots, dude. We're good.
You probably take the high viz off of it, though. Speaking of that, I am working on a giveaway for season two. So,
oh, all right.
We'll see. It's going to be a little bit more legit than the season one giveaway.
I don't know, man. It's hard to beat that. All right. So four seamen and they're all German.
Yeah. So he's got the crew set up. Then next is the cargo. What were they hauling for this?
Yeah.
So on October 20th of 1872, Briggs sails the Mary Celeste into Pier 50 on the East River in New York City. This is sort of the staging ground before you go on your journey.
Okay.
And loaded into it is 1,701 barrels of denatured alcohol.
You have like non-alcoholic beer? Is that what that means?
Kind of the exact opposite of that, actually.
Oh, so just really strong alcohol that hasn't...
Denatured alcohol, think like rubbing alcohol.
Oh, okay. I was like, interesting that he would just ship like crates and crates of moonshine, but like, nobody touch it. Not on this boat.
So the alcohol he's shipping is like, think about super high proof, will take varnish off of stuff, alcohol.
Yeah. Yeah, take a sip and go blind kind of deal.
Yeah, like people are not drinking this alcohol.
Right.
It was used for cleaning, disinfecting, getting lacquers and finishes off of wood. In addition to that, it's highly flammable.
I was about to say, that sounds like a floating bomb.
Yeah, it's highly flammable. It can be toxic to humans. And even just the fumes can cause dizziness.
Okay.
So that's what they have. And this was the first time ever that Benjamin Spooner Briggs shipped alcohol. So he had done lots of runs shipping different things, but this is the first time that his cargo was alcohol.
Okay.
So that was October 20th that he pulls into Pier 50. By Tuesday, November 5th, the Mary Celeste is fully loaded. The crew's on board. They have everything they need. And Mary Celeste leaves Pier 50 with the crew and the cargo and moves into New York Harbor. The ship has not yet gone out into the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. They were done with all the staging. They move into the harbor and they're waiting for suitable weather conditions to take off.
I was going to say, it seems crazy. You're allowed to just bring that much explosive material into the harbor. But I guess I don't know how else you would do it unless you took like tiny little boats over at a time. But
yeah. And there was probably a lot of alcohol being shipped back and forth across the Atlantic at this time. So they probably knew what they were doing as far as like loading it and shipping it and stuff, I would imagine. I mean, I'm not a historian, but I don't know of like tales of ships just blowing up left and right.
Right. I feel like when you're like, and guess what? It's highly flammable. It's like, I don't know where this is going.
Dun, dun, dun.
Then the harbor exploded.
So November 5th moves from the pier into the harbor. And then November 7th, 2 days later, weather eases up and the Mary Celeste leaves the harbor and enters the Atlantic. The journey begins November 7th. Again, research in this episode, the parallels to Dyatlov Pass are like, they're just hitting me upside the head. Because if you remember with that story, it was like there was a lot of staging and getting the crew together and getting ready. Yeah. And then it's like, and then the journey actually starts.
Right.
November 7th, the Mary Celeste goes out into the Atlantic. Now we're going to switch gears a little bit.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about a different boat called the De Gratia. DeiGratia. The De Gratia. This is a Canadian vessel.
Okay.
And it was harbored in Hoboken, New Jersey. And it had a cargo of petroleum destined for Genoa via Gibraltar.
This harbor is just filled with explosives.
A lot of flammable
stuff. Away from harbors.
And I don't think I mentioned it, but the Mary Celeste's destination was Gibraltar.
Okay.
The De Gratia, though, leaves the east coast of the United States a bit later. So the Mary Celeste left November 7th. The De Gratia leaves November 15th. So 8 days later, the De Gratia goes out into the Atlantic.
Okay.
So they leave November 15th. December 4th of that year, the De Gratia reaches a position of 38 degrees 20 minutes north by 17 degrees 15 minutes west. That doesn't mean anything to you. It doesn't mean anything to me either. But this
somewhere in the Atlantic is what that means to me.
So this is midway between the Azores and the coast of Portugal. The Azores is a small collection of islands about 400 miles away from Europe, away from Portugal.
Okay.
So kind of a collection of islands in the middle of the Atlantic, in the middle of nowhere.
So we're a little west of Portugal heading east, I assume.
Coordinates that I just read out, they're a little bit past the Azores, but they're not to Portugal yet.
Right.
They're at that position at about 1 p.m. and the crew call Captain Morehouse. Captain Morehouse was the captain of the De Gratia.
Mm-hmm.
They call him on deck and they say, hey, we spotted a vessel off in the distance and it's something's up with it. Something doesn't look right about this ship.
Okay.
It's sailing a little bit unsteadily and they're used to seeing boats.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying this boat doesn't look right.
Yeah.
Captain Morehouse estimates that this boat is about 6 miles away. He goes back and forth about what they should do, what they should not do. And he says, all right, let's sail towards it.
Hey, we're packed to the gills with gasoline. I've got an idea. Full speed ahead.
So they're about 6 miles away. They say, let's get a little bit closer. Let's see like if somebody's in distress. Let's see if we can spot somebody on board. See if we can help them out in some sort of way. Because he can tell that the way the sails are set, it's not right.
Mm-hmm.
And so something is wrong with this boat. As they get a little bit closer, he identifies the boat as the Mary Celeste. You probably guessed that.
I did.
So he identifies the ship that they've spotted as the Mary Celeste, but he sees nobody on deck. And it would be odd for a ship to be sailing with messed up sails, nobody up on deck trying to do anything about it.
Right.
Or signal for help or anything. So they start signaling the Mary Celeste and nobody's responding. So he sends his first mate, DuVoe, and the second mate, John Wright, over to investigate. And this was after some deliberation. This wasn't just like, hey, get in the boat, go check out what's going on over there. Because pirates were a thing at this time.
Right.
Like legitimate pirates. So he was risking two of his crew's lives to go check this boat out. Because if they got on board and there's pirates, right. Now you're down two crew members. And who knows, they might come over and try to take your own boat.
Right.
So this wasn't a simple, like, let's just help the needy.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, it was a real decision.
Risk assessment.
Yeah, a real risk assessment that he was doing.
Yeah.
So DuVoe and John Wright, they get over to the Mary Celeste and they climb on board and they find the ship completely deserted. They find the sails were partly set. They were in a poor condition. Some of the sails were missing altogether. A lot of the rigging was damaged. And some ropes were hanging loosely over the sides. And they said that it looked like the ship had been abandoned for a little while.
Okay.
And that was sort of the state of things. It wasn't like someone had ripped up the sails or like tore stuff apart. It was just being exposed to the elements for that long. This is what you would expect sails on a boat to look like.
And just based on your description, it doesn't sound like there was any burn marks or anything like that to imply something happened with the cargo to put it into that state.
Right. There's nothing that they could see as far as like burn marks or fire or anything.
Okay.
So they get across, ship's deserted. They find that the main hatch on the boat for loading the cargo, it is still closed. However, the fore and lazarette hatches are open. So those are the two smaller hatches on the boat.
Okay.
So I assume you have one main hatch for loading cargo and then you have two smaller hatches just for access to the cargo.
It's just like a big door, right? That's the thing that slides or opens up, whatever, and then you just drop all your cargo in there.
Yeah. So that one is closed, but the two smaller ones, like if you needed to get down and access the cargo, like not necessarily to load or unload it, those two are open and their covers are sitting beside them on the deck.
Okay.
They find that the lifeboat that was on the Mary Celeste, which was a small yawl, was gone. So the lifeboat is gone. They find that the binnacle housing the ship's compass had shifted from its place and the glass cover was broken. So the binnacle is, if you've ever seen like any old ship show or anything, it's like the glass thing in the captain's compartment that has like the compass and all that stuff in it.
Okay.
So they find that that has shifted to somewhere it wouldn't have been set and the glass on it is broken.
Okay.
So the navigational instruments have been messed with on the boat.
Did it look like it was from human interaction? Or I guess given the state of the boat, hard to say what would have been the cause.
Yeah. Hard to say. They didn't make a determination at that point about that. They used a sounding rod, which is just something that they would use to check depth of water. Mm-hmm. They used a sounding rod and they found that there were about 3.5 feet of water in the hold of the ship. And to you and I, that sounds like a lot. But from everything I read, that's not it. It's not an alarming amount of water to be in the bottom of this ship.
Oh, that's
like
normal.
3.5 feet. That's like maybe in a little while we need to think about this, but it's not an emergency.
Okay.
It's not like we got to get this water out of this boat right now type of thing.
Yeah. I'd be the new guy in the corps like, there's a problem.
We're going down.
Jump overboard. Hurry. There's right. No time.
Yeah. So it was not an amount of water that would warrant like a quick exit from the boat.
Right.
They found that the cabin interiors, so where all the people slept and ate and everything, they were wet and untidy from like weather, but otherwise fairly organized.
Okay.
Like people's clothing was where it should be. The food was stored. Everything was how you would expect it to be. Like there was no signs of a struggle.
Just looked a little lived in.
Yeah. There were no signs of a struggle. There were no signs of a panic. There wasn't anything crazy going on. And then they went into Captain Briggs' cabin and they found a few items scattered about. They found a sword that was sheathed under the bed. They found most of the ship's papers were missing and the captain's personal navigational instruments were gone.
Mm-hmm.
The galley, where all the food is, where everybody eats on the boat, all the equipment was neatly stowed away. There was no food prepared or under preparation, so nobody like left all of a sudden, like in the middle of cooking something or eating something.
Is it normal to have a sword under your bed? I mean, I guess if you're worried about pirates or whatever else.
I would imagine that they would take some weaponry along with them of some sort. The sword will come up later, though.
Oh, okay.
They found that the boat had 6 months worth of food left on the ship. So this was not a situation where they didn't have enough food and they needed to get off the boat.
Right.
And then they find the ship's log. So where they log all of the important things that have happened on this boat.
Mm-hmm.
And they find that after setting out on November 7th, they battled heavy weather for about 2 weeks, but they did reach the Azores. And the last entry was recorded at 5 a.m. on November 25th. So if you remember, the De Gratia found the Mary Celeste on December 4th.
Okay.
So the Mary Celeste had been afloat 9 to 10 days.
Yeah.
They find, like I said, the last record is from November 25th. At that point, the Mary Celeste position was 37 degrees 1 minute north by 25 degrees 1 minute west off of the Azores. So this is hundreds of miles from where the De Gratia found the Mary Celeste.
Okay.
So the Mary Celeste in those 9 days had drifted hundreds of miles.
So in the ship log, I guess they just write, here's our coordinates, here's the time of day, here's any interesting things that came up or...
Yeah, yeah.
All is normal.
You know, this was the weather today. This is our new position. This is our heading, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think it was like a personal journal for the captain. He's like,
today Jeff yelled at me and I'm mad about it. Yeah, gotcha.
Yeah. And so the ship is hundreds of miles from the last log entry. Then they go back onto the deck of the boat. They find a rope tied to the back of the boat and it is trailing behind the boat.
Yep.
It was later found that 9 of the barrels of alcohol were empty.
Hmm.
So of the 1,701 barrels, 9 of them were empty.
Okay.
They said there were no obvious signs of fire, no obvious signs of violence, and all of the evidence pointed to an orderly departure from the ship by means of the lifeboat. So everything points to they got on the lifeboat with the captain's navigational gear and left.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is our why did they leave the tent moment.
Yeah. And why would they take very strong alcohol or what would they do with it before?
Right. And so the question is, why did they leave the boat?
Yeah.
We know that they did. We have a pretty good idea how they left. We just have no idea why. So the first mate, Duvaux, goes back to the De Gratia. He reports all these findings to Captain Morehouse. And Captain Morehouse, again, another moment of what do I do in this situation? There's nobody on board, et cetera, et cetera. And he ends up deciding to send three of his crew members back to the Mary Celeste to sail it into Gibraltar. Because at that time, and maybe it might still be the case, there's maritime law of salvage.
Okay.
And so if you find a ship that is abandoned or whatnot, and it has cargo on it,
right.
If you get that boat into port, then you're entitled to a portion of the money from the cargo.
I mean, and that's a potentially like doubling your payday. So easy to see why they would make a go for that.
Right. He sends three of his crew over to the Mary Celeste. So you essentially have two skeleton crews sailing two ships. So it's like all hands on deck 24/7 sailing these ships. And that's why it wasn't an easy decision for him, because you're essentially bare bones crew. And so if something goes wrong on either one of these ships, you're threatening the lives of everybody else on board.
Right. And I imagine the sell to them was, if we do this, we're going to make a ton of money. So let's go for it.
Yeah.
So how far from Gibraltar are they roughly at this point?
At this point, they're 600 miles away from Gibraltar.
Which sounds like a lot to me.
Yeah, I would say that's a lot. So that was December 4th
okay.
when they found it split up. They both start sailing in, and the De Gratia ends up getting to Gibraltar on December 12th. So the De Gratia sails in. They're like, hey, you won't believe what just happened here. And then the Mary Celeste just doesn't show up until the next morning.
Yeah.
But you know that was a long night for the captain.
Well, I was curious how close they would sail together, if it's like, all right, let's just go tandem, or if it's like you'd mess each other's float patterns or whatever. You know how boats work, right?
So the Mary Celeste rolls in the next morning, December 13th, and as expected, it is immediately impounded. We got to figure out what happened with this boat. We got to figure out what to do with it.
But in theory, they still own the stock or whatever, right?
In theory, yes.
Oh, like make sure they didn't just like kill everybody and
exactly
yoink
there has to be some sort of hearing
due process and, yeah okay gotcha.
Like you said, they couldn't just like jump on like throw everybody overboard like, and be like,
oh, the blood stains, don't worry about it. But we did find a lot of extra strength alcohol.
And Duveau, the captain of the De Gratia, appeared to be kind of distraught about this whole thing. There's just boat with a missing crew, that's 10 people that are just gone.
Yeah.
He wrote to his wife, quote, I can hardly tell what I am made of, but I do not care so long as I got in safe. I shall be well paid for the Mary Celeste. So he's acknowledging this was hard. I'm happy I'm alive, but we might get a payday from this.
Yeah. That was the captain who wrote that?
Yeah. The captain of the De Gratia.
Okay.
So then begins the salvage hearing. So the salvage hearing starts December 17th, 1872, under Sir James Cochrane, the Chief Justice of Gibraltar, and the person, I guess, prosecuting, he ends up trying to prosecute them, but the person like heading this investigation is Frederick Solly Flood. He is the Attorney General of Gibraltar. And right from the get-go, Flood is convinced there's foul play on the De Gratia crew. He hasn't even stepped foot on the Mary Celeste. He hasn't done anything. Mm-hmm. He just, right from the get-go, is like, yeah, this De Gratia crew is sketchy. I don't trust them.
Right.
So he orders a full investigation on December 23rd. So they've already been there 11 days, and they're just starting a full investigation.
And I was going to say, so the Mary Celeste crew, from the sound of it, alcohol abstinent, but this crew, I guess we don't really know their leanings.
Yeah, not necessarily. But again, this isn't alcohol you would want to drink.
True. I just mean that the one ship, like when I hear that, I'm like, oh, very religious. Like they're not going to go do anything. This other ship, we don't know that crew as well as far as what their background is for what they may or may not be capable of.
Yeah, we don't know that crew as in depth. There's some rumors that Spooner Briggs and the De Gratia captain Morehouse knew each other. There's one report that like they had dinner together at some point, but I think a lot of that is like fictionalized takes on it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the sailors of that day that are going between, you know, New York and London or New York and Gibraltar, they kind of know each other.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I wouldn't be surprised if Morehouse had heard of Spooner Briggs, but you're right. We don't know a whole lot about the crew of the De Gratia.
Okay.
So Solly Flood orders the investigation. That investigation is carried out by John Austin. John Austin investigates the Mary Celeste. He notes that there are cuts on each side of the bow, caused, he believed, by a sharp instrument. And he says he found possible traces of blood on the captain's sword. So that sword that was found under the bed, took it out of the sheath, and he said, hey, I think that might be blood.
Yep.
His report emphasized that the ship did not appear to have been struck by heavy weather, or was it run aground. He says that in investigating the ship, there is a vial of sewing machine oil found upright and in its place. So it was weather worn.
Oh, I see. Like it didn't tip over from weather. Yeah.
So when they got on the boat, the weather had done its thing to this ship just by virtue of windows being open and nobody there to maintain the sails and everything.
Right.
But everything else was pretty well kept in place. There wasn't trash strewn about. There wasn't broken bottles or anything.
Right.
And the example he gives is that there was a vial of sewing machine oil that was just sitting in its place, still full.
So the blood on the sword's kind of the outlier red flag.
Yeah. And then he also says that he believes he found stains on one of the ship's rails that may have been blood, and a deep mark possibly caused by an axe. So that's the initial investigation done by John Austin.
Okay.
Solly Flood comes back in on January 22nd, 1873. He sends all the reports to the trade board in London, and he says that he believes what happened is the crew of the Mary Celeste got into the alcohol, ended up murdering Captain Briggs and his family, and then fled in the lifeboat.
Hmm.
That is Solly Flood's conclusion from the investigation, which it doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, seemed like a pretty chill crew.
Yeah. The idea that they would decide to break open one of these barrels of denatured alcohol, down it, and then just go into a frenzy and murder three people, and then be like, uh-oh, let's get in this lifeboat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
There's too many things there that don't make sense to me.
When you said even the fumes make you dizzy, like if you have nine barrels of it, I don't think you're going to be
like gallons. You would just be dead. You wouldn't even be functional enough to try to kill someone.
Maybe unless you're like some psychosis from, you know, really going for it.
If you just downed like 5 gallons of rubbing alcohol,
I think you would just throw up on yourself a lot and then have a bad time.
Just die. So that's the report that he sends to the Board of Trade in London, is basically like, I don't trust anything that's going on here. Everybody's mean. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know what his personal vendetta against all of this was, but he does not like this whole situation. While all this is going on, Morehouse, who was making the claim, the salvage claim, had to stay in Gibraltar. And so all that petroleum that was on the De Gratia is not being delivered. So he's not getting the money from the initial voyage. So Morehouse stays in Gibraltar, but he sends his first mate to Genoa to deliver the petroleum. So he's basically like, look, I'll stay here while this Flood guy investigates this whole thing. You got to get the cargo to where it needs to be, because like, we need our payday. We can't just be existing on no income.
Yeah, right.
He sends them on, and this like enrages Solly Flood. How dare you send your crew off while we're doing this investigation against your crew?
Mm-hmm.
So Solly Flood, even further enraged.
Right.
James Winchester, the majority owner of the Mary Celeste, he gets to Gibraltar January 15th. So a little bit before the report was sent to London, he has caught wind of what's going on, that there's a salvage hearing against his boat, etc. So he shows up, and Flood demands $15,000 to release the boat so it can make its delivery.
Interesting. This is in Gibraltar.
And so Flood then starts thinking that Winchester planted a crew on the Mary Celeste in order to kill Briggs as some sort of conspiracy. Flood is just going from like thing to thing
He's
to
going
thing. Like, yeah,
there's
like
theory.
No way to like disprove what's going on. So Flood's going in about Briggs was killed, the crew tried to kill him, etc. stuff. And then they get some of the scientific analysis of the stuff back.
Yeah.
And they find that the blood stains on the sword and I think one of the railings was not blood at all. They don't know what it was. It could have been rust.
Water stain.
Yeah, something.
I wonder how they would test that back then.
Yeah, I don't know how they would test that back then.
Somebody just takes a lick. Oh, it's just water stain, dude. You're good.
So they determine it is not blood. And then the report also says that the odd marks or the axe marks that they found on the bow in different places of the ship, they were actually either just from the way the ship hit the waves going through the ocean over and over and over again, it would make marks like that. And some of them were just from when the ship was built. Like, you have to axe wood in order to get wood to build a ship.
Yeah. Or just wear and tear. I mean, it's, yeah, you know, in salt water, like, all the time.
Yeah. So the investigation comes back and it's basically like, yeah, Flood, just like, chill out. There's no blood. There's no, like, wild axe marks. Like, there's no evidence that the Winchester hired a crew to kill Briggs and then just die in the Atlantic.
I'm picturing, like, a little tiny dude with, like, a Napoleon complex.
Yeah. I wonder what the dimensions of Solly Flood were. So he very reluctantly releases the Mary Celeste from the court's jurisdiction on February 25th. So 2.5 months after the ship was brought in, he releases the ship. So this is like, you've lost a lot of income just from the cargo just sitting there for 2.5 months.
Yeah, yeah. Did he get paid anything, do we know, for that release?
Did Flood, did the attorney get paid anything?
Yeah. So they finally released the boat. Was that because they're like, fine, just pay him and then we'll just eat this cost?
No. Flood was the attorney general, but the judge ultimately found, we can't prove that any wrongdoing happened.
Oh, gotcha, gotcha.
So we have to release this vessel.
So they probably just got tired of like Flood's nonsense. We're like, just release the boat.
Yeah. Dude. So they release the boat back to Winchester. He finds a crew to finally go deliver the denatured alcohol to where it needs to be. And that was February 25th. So again, 2.5 months afterward, The question of salvage payment still hasn't been settled. But on April 8th, so 4.5 months after the De Gratia crew brought the ship in, The judge announces, all right, I am going to award you your salvage money. And they get $1,700, or about 1/5 of the total value of the ship and cargo. 4.5 months. And basically the judge, he gives them like, you know, a pittance. And in the ruling essentially alludes to, y'all killed this crew and took the boat, but we just can't prove it. So I have to pay you. So I'm going to give you the minimum amount that I have to give you.
So it wasn't some like law about salvage where you get a portion. He kind of took Flood's side a little bit.
Yeah. Then? Yeah. The judge kind of took Flood's side. I don't think there's a law about a specific amount, but you have to be given some amount of salvage money if you bring a ship in. And so the judge said, well, because I know you did something wrong, I'm going to give you the minimum I'm allowed to give you.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So the De Gratia crew, thinking they were going to do a good deed, bring this ship in, get a good payday, end up hung up in court for 4.5 months and get next to nothing for it.
They were probably ready to go back with, I assume you take stuff both directions or get your payday and go home. That truly wrecks your business pipeline.
Oh, yeah, because you can't. I mean, they could have made another trip or two in that time. Instead, they're just SOL.
And I wonder if they pull the kind of thing where like, oh, and also marina fees, like to be docked here or whatever, you know, pay XYZ. Like, it sounds like they're just kind of trying to screw them over.
Yeah. Yeah. So the De Gratia crew, in my opinion, was trying to do the right thing and ended up getting messed over for it.
Yeah.
That kind of ends the main part of the story, but I do want to touch on the final voyage of the Mary Celeste.
Okay.
Because after the salvage hearing, they continue to use it to ship things back and forth. February 1879, ship's been used for a while to ship things back and forth. And then they're off the island of St. Helena and they call for medical assistance for the captain. Edgar Tuthill has fallen ill. And Tuthill ends up dying on the island, and he's the third captain to die prematurely that is associated with this boat.
Okay.
And then finally, November of 1884, at that point, the ship's captain was Captain Parker. He gets with a group of Boston shippers, and he says, hey, let's kind of cook the books here. you load up a bunch of nonsense basically into the cargo hold. We'll list it as really expensive goods. We'll list it as, you know, high dollar items. And then I'll insure the boat for a bunch of money.
Yep.
So they go through this scheme. He insures the boat for $30,000. That'd be about $1 million today.
Okay.
And then on December 16th, he sets out for Port-au-Prince. I think that's how you say that. The capital and port in Haiti. And on January 3rd, they're approaching the port. The port has well-known, documented, mapped coral reefs around it. Mm-hmm. And he just intentionally rams the boat into one of the coral reefs and says, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I just sank the boat. Right. Hey, insurance, pay up." And tries to run that insurance scam, trying to get paid for
things that weren't even on the boat.
Yeah, they filled the cargo with like used shoes and stuff and said they had like a bunch of jewelry and stuff in it.
I feel like you gotta throw at least a few decoys in there if you show up. You're like, "Oh, it's just like a whole bunch of Nikes. Like, this doesn't make sense."
So the insurance people, they show up, they do an investigation. They're like, "Well, hold on a minute. That's not what you said is in there."
Yeah.
So he gets caught. Scam doesn't work out. And he ends up getting charged legally for that. But he was allowed to go free for some reason. But his professional reputation was ruined. And he ends up dying 3 months later. Another one of his co-defendants, quote unquote, went mad. And a third co-defendant ended up taking his own life shortly after all the hearings and everything. The judge in the case, he was quoted as saying, "The court of man could not punish these men. The curse that had deviled the ship since her first skipper, Robert McClellan, had died on her maiden voyage could reach beyond the vessel's watery grave and exact its own terrible retribution."
So this boat's reputation follows it from the start.
Yeah.
It sounds like then. Yeah.
So that's kind of the end of the Mary Celeste. So let's get back to our why'd they leave the tent moment. Why'd they leave the boat?
Yeah.
Are we ready for the theories section?
Always.
Theories is probably my favorite part of these.
I think also since I'm taking it all in real time, it's where I start to actually wrap my head around the possibilities. Like as we go, I'll make little notes of what kind of sticks out to me. But then I think just talking it out loud, I kind of sometimes get there. And then you'll do yours and be like, "Oh, no, wait, that's the one."
I'm going to make a prediction to everybody out there.
Okay, yeah, what you got?
I'm going to read through these theories. I'm going to count this out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. There's 8 theories.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that Evan's conclusion will include at least 4 of them.
And then I'll hear you read the other 3 and I'll be like, "Oh yeah, and a little splash of that one."
This one actually, it's going to be hard for me to hide, but there's one theory that I really lean towards.
With what I've heard so far.
Yeah. So what's your theory with no theories listed for you? What do you think happened?
Well, and I think there's multiple questions here.
Okay.
I think to start off with what you led in with is why did they leave the boat?
Okay.
And that one, I feel like maybe they ran into a smaller pirate group, ship, what have you. Because there was, well, I guess just those crates were empty. I keep thinking that somebody like left with those. I can't figure out why those would be empty.
You will soon.
And the sword maybe was blood. Doesn't sound like it was once they started kind of testing everything.
Once they were licking the sword.
Licking the sword, as they say. I just have a hard time trusting their science back then to be like, it's blood or it's not blood. The other question is like, was this Gibraltar court just like super corrupt? That's kind of how it sounds to me.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some like racism against the English shipping company, but that still doesn't, that kind of is just the legalese part that we end up in.
Yeah.
And the part about them leaving the boat. Yeah. I just don't know why.
This is one of those keep me up at night episodes that we do.
Yeah. Like why would pirates come aboard, kill everybody and then not take anything or just take the whole boat?
Exactly.
That's how I would expect that to play out. And my theory, I guess, as I figured out in real time, as I tend to, is ran into bad weather. I know the boat didn't look too terrible, but there's still like broken navigation equipment, something like that. But then I don't know why they would take the lifeboat out if the weather was bad. That'd be an even worse ship to be in, I would guess, because they're smaller, more likely to, you know, go under, I would guess.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe I just need to hear your theory so I can start seeing how I want to cherry pick and combine everything. Yeah.
So let's roll through these theories. But we do some episodes, like let's say Dover Demon. To me, that's just a fun episode. I have fun thinking about what that creature could have been or wasn't or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But it's episodes like this one and like the Dyatlov Pass episode that literally keep me up at night.
Yeah.
Like I have woken up in the middle of the night thinking, like, why would they have gotten on this lifeboat? Like, this is one of those episodes that's going to stick with me, trying to figure out what in the world's going on.
No, I agree. And I think I'm wired the same way, where the more fantastical stuff, I'm just like, yeah, let's roll through the theories. Oh, that's fun. You know, there's some comedic ones in the mix. Sure, why not?
Yeah.
But when I can't follow the logical trail is when it gets almost frustrating. When you think you kind of have it nailed down, or even like a lane it might be following, you kind of ask your own question. You're like, well, I guess it wouldn't be that.
Yeah. So let's jump in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's run through these. So the first theory is foul play. Essentially, Sally Flood was right. There was some sort of mutiny either on board the Mary Celeste or some sort of foul play on part of the DeGradia crew. Mm-hmm. There's some sort of scheme going on to get the salvage money. Basically, his theory was right, that there was some sort of foul play going on. So the difficulty I have with that one, amongst the stuff we've already discussed, is that the DeGradia left the port over a week after the Mary Celeste. So they happened upon the Mary Celeste. Like, there's no way that they could have like left the port and been like, all right, let's get the engines in the ground, in the water. Like, we're going to catch up to them. Like, it doesn't make any sense.
That's a good point.
That they would plan to take over the Mary Celeste, because they would have never caught up to it.
And like you said, too, these guys are probably doing the same route over and over, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some deviations, but I imagine it's, hey, we're the ship that always goes to Gibraltar and comes back. They would know each other. I don't know that I can get there.
Yeah, that theory, not holding a lot of weight for me. The next theory is pirates.
Yeah.
Piracy. Mm-hmm. Pirates came on board. Maybe they killed all the crew. They were like, we're taking all the cargo. And then they go into the cargo hold and they're like, well, hold on a minute. This is like cleaning solution alcohol. It's no use to us. And then they just leave the boat.
Yeah.
So that's that theory.
So what if they got on board, saw these boxes were marked alcohol after they killed everybody else and think, oh, sweet, party time. But then they poison themselves with all the alcohol because it's not actually fit for consumption. And then I guess there would still be like a dead body or two still around, unless it was like, yeah, like we're saying, psychosis kicks in. They're like, all right, just jump off the boat.
There'd be some sign of struggle. I'd imagine there would be some very obvious blood stains.
Yeah, that's true. It's the nine empty barrels. I just can't figure out.
And, you know, a barrel of alcohol is something like 55 gallons. So like when we're talking, like, this isn't like, not even pirates are jumping on board and drinking like 400 gallons of denatured alcohol. So it is a lot. So piracy, I'm not buying that. The next one is something called ergot poisoning. So ergot poisoning is a mold that grows on grains and it can cause like hallucinations and some wild stuff. I think there was, I'm going to get the century wrong on this, but like the 1500s, there's a famous case of ergot poisoning where a bunch of people in this town started dancing and just like didn't stop dancing, and like some of them died, like they danced themselves to death.
Really going for that Running Man.
Yeah, so so ergot poisoning,
sorry, I'm picturing this party.
So the idea would be that some of the bread on the ship basically had been infected by this ergot mold and poisoned the crew. They started hallucinating, and that got to a point that they were like, oh my God, we got to get off the ship. And some sort of mass hysteria took over and they left. Mm. The detractor to that is the DeGratia crew that sailed it from where they found it into Gibraltar, ate the food that was left on the Mary Celeste.
Okay.
And they obviously didn't get ergot poisoning or anything like that. There's a couple natural phenomenon that are worth talking about. The first one being a water spout, which is basically like a water tornado.
Right.
Most of the time, water spouts are fairly harmless, but they can get pretty destructive from time to time. Like a water spout can get up to 100 mile an hour winds.
Yeah.
So we're not talking like F5 tornado, but like they can get pretty dangerous.
Right.
And so the theory with that one is they're sailing along, they see one of these more intense water spouts coming towards the boat, and they can't steer the boat away quick enough. So they decide to get into the lifeboat and try to get away from the water spout. And then they can't make it back to the boat after the water spout passes.
Okay.
Again, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to get into a smaller, more vulnerable position.
Yeah. Every time I think the little boat's like some sort of escape pod, I'm like, that doesn't really make sense unless the boat is itself going down, which we know it wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The other natural phenomenon is a sea quake. So this is just an earthquake, but out at sea.
Yeah.
This is what causes a lot of like tsunamis,
right,
that you hear about. Like anytime there's a sea quake in the middle of the ocean, everywhere around there, all the coastlines around there, and put on a tsunami watch.
Right.
So something like that happened. And there is a fault line between the Azores and Gibraltar. So like there is a fault line that they would have been near or sailing past. And so the idea is that like a massive sea quake hit, the waves started getting crazy and they panicked and got in the lifeboat. Again, why would you put yourself in a more vulnerable position?
Well, and like you're saying, they had the sewing machine oil looked fine.
Yeah.
So it didn't seem like enough stuff was in duress to really back that up.
Yeah, like all the kitchen equipment is set.
Yeah.
And this is another parallel to the Dyatlov Pass episode, because like regardless of what happened,
yeah,
they put themselves into a worse situation getting into the lifeboat.
Right.
So like, why would you do that? Why would you go out into the cold from this tent? Why would you go into the lifeboat from this ship? The next one, I'm going to skip the last one because it's just going to be obvious that that's the one that I favor.
Okay.
And I'm going to go to my last one. You guessed it. It is a cursed ship.
Right.
They used some cursed trees to build it. Somebody cast a spell on it.
Yeah.
There's just bad juju with this ship, and it was just fated to happen. Three captains die prematurely. You had the captain with the insurance fraud die a few months after that whole thing at the very end. One of the other crew members ended up killing himself. They're running into things on the maiden voyage.
Yep.
Just overall, the ship was just cursed. And that curse took the crew in some sort of way and dispatched them to the depths, let's say.
Yep.
And so moving to last theory, that there was some sort of issue with the alcohol on board. So they had 1,701 barrels of denatured alcohol, as I've said 400 times so far in this episode. Like I said, 9 of the barrels were empty.
Yeah.
When they analyzed it, and I kind of intentionally didn't add this detail in there, when they analyzed these barrels, they found that these 9 barrels were the only 9 barrels that were made out of red oak. Red oak is a much more porous wood than the standard white oak that barrels were made of usually.
Right.
And so the theory, essentially, that I've worked out, I didn't create this theory, but just having read through all of this stuff, these 9 barrels that were made of red oak, they weren't emptied by anyone. The alcohol seeped out of them. And because it was such a high proof, essentially vaporized, it evaporated into the air. So you had 9 barrels of alcohol basically in a vapor form in the hold of this ship with nobody knowing. And then something happened. Maybe the ship rolled one way or the other. 2 barrels rubbed together. Maybe somebody lit a candle on the ship's, on the bridge. What's the top of the ship?
Mast.
No, where you walk. On the deck. The deck. There
deck,
we go.
Yeah.
We're terrible with boat stuff.
It's funny because my great-grandpa was a riverboat captain.
Oh, okay.
I just got pictures this week of it. My grandpa tried to teach me how to use a speedboat, and there was just a lot of profanity in that process. So boats may just not be my thing.
No, they're not mine either. So these 9 barrels of alcohol vaporized, essentially, and then a spark of some sort happened. 2 of the metal pieces of a barrel rubbed together. Someone lit a candle. Something happened. Someone lit a pipe, maybe. And there was sort of this massive flash explosion. So like, you know, if you're weird, and I used to do this in college, if you have get a lighter and you just hold it open in your hand.
I'm only laughing because I probably did that in the last like week or two. I'm like, just get in here.
Like you cup your hand and you hold open the lighter and then you flick it. You get a little fireball shoot out of your hand.
Yeah.
basically that on like a massive scale happened.
I like that you say college, and I'm like, I think we did this way earlier than that together, like in our friend's backyard.
We probably did. I have a distinct memory of coming over to your mom's house one time and you being like, David, I figured it out. And I'm like, what did you figure out? And you're like, I know how to make napalm.
Don't tell mom. Let's go to the garage.
You were like, come here. Yeah, yeah. We went in the garage and you were like, watch this. And you just took a piece of styrofoam and like melted it into the gasoline. You were like, now it's a jelly. That's napalm.
When I made it, I thought it would like be a little more combustible. Really, it's just like a tiny little flame that, you know, burns over time. But I do have a very weak sense of smell, and I often wonder if it's attributed to, you know, being 11 and making napalm in the garage. So we'll see on that one.
Oh, God. So huge flash explosion happens. It's not strong enough to open the main hatch, but it opens the two access hatches.
Oh, interesting.
Basically, yeah. Flames start shooting out of those so that anybody on the deck would see these massive fireballs basically shooting out of the hatches.
Yeah.
And then the crew sees this. They realize we have 1,701 barrels of alcohol down there. There's a fire. Mm-hmm. This boat is about to explode.
Yeah.
We got to go. They gather up their stuff real quick. The captain grabs his navigational equipment. They get in the yawl and they get off the ship.
Hmm.
Not realizing that it was just like a quick flash burn of the vapors and nothing really was in danger. Because a flash burn, there's not going to be evidence of burn marks. Stuff's not going to light on fire. It's so quick and sudden that there's not enough time for even paper to light on fire.
Yeah.
It's just like a boom. And then that's that. But it was enough that the crew panicked because Benjamin Spooner Briggs, the captain, had never shipped alcohol before. So he wasn't familiar with the properties of this.
You don't think it would blow up the other barrels when it does that? I guess you said they're less porous, so maybe insulated just enough to not...
Yeah, that's the detractor to this theory, is that there was a lot of alcohol on that ship. If these 9 barrels of vapor lit up, you'd imagine some vapor was coming out of the other barrels.
But, you know, like I said, not as porous, maybe just enough to not, you know, have the whole ship kick off.
Maybe just enough that the vapor ignited and that was that. And so that's the theory that I favor, obviously, that there's some sort of like flash explosion.
Yeah.
And the crew got in the boat. And if you remember, there was a rope trailing the boat. So I think it's possible that the crew got into the lifeboat, but had it tied to the back of the Mary Celeste.
Mm.
And then somehow or another, it got untied and they got lost at sea. The idea is that they were panicking because they saw a massive fireball shoot out of the hold.
Yeah.
And they just figured the ship was about to go up in flames.
Which is, a fair assessment when you're carrying a bunch of highly flammable. I don't know if I'm fully sold on that theory, but there's parts of it I'm like, I can wrap my head around and be like, okay, sure, parts of that maybe.
So that's all the theories.
Before getting to that theory, though, when I was listening to the others, I was doing my combo move.
What you got?
So De Gratia, am I pronouncing that right?
De Gratia.
De Gratia.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe they did kill everybody on that boat and then use some of that alcohol to clean up the scene of the crime.
Okay.
But the hole in that theory, I guess, was to your point where they left so much later than them. I don't know how they catch up without something having happened on that boat. But I was starting to think if there's a reason to use that rubbing alcohol, if you can't really drink it, but it is like for cleaning or whatever. But this also isn't really in the type of like forensic science, but I guess the alcohol could be used to like just kind of clean up the scene and then be like, hey, it was abandoned, and then take that in. And then I think Flood is kind of an outlier in the story for me, just in the sense that him and the judge, I think, are also just like a little bit corrupt and maybe just waiting for a payout. I think that long in harbor, like they were just waiting for one of them to be like, we'll give you 10 grand to just like let us get out of here.
Some sort of payoff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he did investigate it and was saying, I think you guys did that. So if not, there is more evidence that maybe they were the De Gratia. De Gratia. You know, we don't know as much about them. So I, you know, maybe they did something and then just cleaned up.
So you're thinking it's possible that like the Mary Celeste was in distress, but the crew was still on board, and then the De Gratia caught up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, well, if we just off these people, then we can get the money.
Yeah.
So something happened with the Mary Celeste.
It would have to, I guess, right, for them to catch up. I think something would have to happen there.
Yeah.
And again, this is also reach, but only because I understand the flash burn theory or whatever you want to call that one, but it still doesn't quite get me there. So per usual, I'm trying to fill in all these gaps into some ultra theory that no one can disprove because there's no logic behind it. But also just the fun mystery angle of that side, if that is kind of how it played out.
Okay. Okay. In my head, the DeGratia crew is free of any blame.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's any wrongdoing on their part because, like you said, one, they would have had to catch up to this ship.
Yeah.
They couldn't have been premeditated because they wouldn't have known that they could have caught up to this ship.
Right.
And so they would have had to be on this journey to Gibraltar. And then, you know, December 4th, they wake up and they're like, hey, there's a ship over there. And the captain's like, let's take them over. it doesn't make sense that the captain of the DeGratia would just be like, you know what? I want two ships going to Gibraltar today.
Right. right.
Like, I'm going to split my crew up. Y'all are going to go murder some people. And then
easy peasy.
You use only the red oak barrels to get the alcohol to clean.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
There's a lot of, I don't think the DeGratia crew did anything wrong. I think Flood was just an angry, angry man.
Yeah.
He decided in his head what he believed before any evidence had come through, I think.
Yeah. And like I said, I think that may stem just from they're not from here or rival shipping company to, you know, who knows, especially if he's in the pocket of taking bribes from some other local shippers or something like that, you know, who knows?
Yeah. And so, like I said, I lean towards the flash fire theory, but you're right. I don't know if a flash fire could happen with all of that alcohol on board and not ignite any of it.
Yeah. And I was wondering, would there be a reason to store the red oak ones somewhere else? But I imagine it's all got to be in the same stockade. I don't know why you would split them up unless it was like a known thing like, oh, these are porous and leach out dangerous fumes, in which case I'd be like, maybe we pass on those.
That is a good question, though, if they were stored in the same area or they were just like evenly distributed amongst all the other barrels.
Because I wonder why only 9 of them. It's a weird thing that I don't think I'll have an answer for.
Yeah. Only 9 of them were red oak. Like the Outlaw of Pass, I don't think we'll ever get a satisfactory answer to this.
And similar to that one also, just a lot of mystery to the way or ways people died.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got some various captains dying of different things. You got a 10-person crew that disappeared. There's never been any trace of them or the lifeboat ever found.
Hmm.
They essentially vanished into thin air. I don't think we'll ever get an answer to it.
Maybe it's a real ghost ship. Could be the one.
Like I said, cursed ship.
One of these times it's going to be that one. No, very cool. So anything else we need for the Mary Celeste to kind of tie it up?
I think that about wraps up the Mary Celeste. We'll be back 2 weeks from today with Sam the Sandown Clown.
Ooh.
We're in September now. We'll be in October for that episode. And so, you know, October's spooky month.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to pick some stories and episodes that lean more towards spooky than anything else. And if I remember correctly, you at least used to have a phobia of clowns.
Oh, I was just about to ask, like, what's your vibe with clowns? Because I was like, oh, I don't want those pictures. Send me nondescript in the middle of the night.
I'm gonna send them to you at 5 in the morning when you're most asleep.
It's like humans that are not doing human things, which to me is a clown. Or like mannequins, just like humanoid things that aren't being human just really freak me out. So that'll be a fun one.
You're a victim of the uncanny valley.
Yes, 100%.
So yeah, we're going to cover Sam the Sandown Clown 2 weeks from now. And then 2 weeks from that, the second episode in October, we're going to, again, just lean into the spooky side of stuff more so than anything else. So
why not?
You can come back for that. Evan, you want to tell them where to reach us?
I do, if I can. So as usual, we are at the Oddity Archive Podcast on Instagram, and our Gmail handle is theoddityarchivepodcast@gmail.com. Always down to get any thoughts, comments, requests, anything like that. And yeah, I don't know anything else, Dave, or should we just tell them we'll see them in the next one?
We'll catch you on the next one.
Sweet.
I am David Stooldreyer, creator and host. The show is edited by my co-host, Evan Miller. All original music created by Sean Bullock. You can follow him at Sean Bullock Video on Instagram. All original artwork done by Tanis. Follow her at Tanis Tattoos on Instagram as well. Thank you for listening.